Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I am Yu Yunzhan, host of our monthly podcast, Zhonghua Mundus, that brings you recent updates about China's economy. As usual, I am with our senior fellow, Alicia Garcia-Herrero.
Hello, Yu Yun.
Hi, Alicia. Welcome back. We're also glad to have with us today two guest speakers, Isabelle Mejean, economics professor from Sciences Po, the Paris Institute of Political Studies. Welcome, Isabelle.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining. We're also glad to have with us today Vincent Vicard, deputy director of CEP, the leading French center for research and expertise on the world economy. Together, they just contributed to one chapter of the Paris Report, a joint CEPR-Bruegel initiative that produces in-depth studies of topical policy issues concerning Europe. This year, the Paris Report examines the return of global imbalances amid rising geopolitical tension, financial fragility, and shifting trade dynamics. So my colleague Rebecca Christie already discussed the general report with Bruegel director Jeremy Zettelmeyer and CEPR president Beatrice Weathered-Mauro in last week's podcast. But in this episode today, we will focus on another chapter of the report written by Isabelle and Vincent together with two other co-authors, also from CEP. They look at Chinese trade deflation and try to put hard numbers on a question European policymakers have long debated anecdotally. How much of what China can no longer sell to the US ends up on Europe's doorstep? Isabelle, could you set the scene for us? What is trade deflation and how did you examine it in your study?
So what we try to study in this chapter is a kind of side effect of any unilateral discriminatory trade policy that we call the deflection of trade towards third countries. So in 2018, 2019, as well as more recently in 2025, the US administration has decided unilaterally to raise tariffs against a number of their largest trade partners, and especially China. So in 2018, 2019, we're talking about an average increase of tariffs faced by China of more than 20 percentage points that was applied through successive waves covering an increasing number of targeted products. And in 2025, likewise, we're talking about the two fentanyl tariffs of 10 percentage points each that were introduced in February, followed by the 34 percentage points increase after Liberation Day. So in both cases, what we saw in the data is that the impact on China's access to the US market was massive and substantially larger than any other tariff targeting the rest of the world. So this represents a massive demand shock for Chinese firms. And what we dig into in this paper is the extent to which this demand shock has been partially absorbed through the redirection of exports to third countries. And this is what we call trade deflection. So what we do more specifically, the empirical strategy, is going to compare products that were targeted by the US administration to those that were not, both before and after the implementation of the tariff. And under the assumption that the structural growth of exports does not systematically vary across those groups, we can interpret the difference in the dynamics of exports across those groups as being caused by the tariff. So what we show is that this strategy proved quite powerful in the context of the 2018-2019 trade war. And the reason is that we have these successive waves of tariffs that we can use in a difference in different settings. So based on this, we find strong evidence of trade deflection. While exports to the US decreased by about 30% within 15 months in targeted markets, we instead observe a rise in Chinese exports to the rest of the world. And for the European Union, the cumulated rise in exports is equal to 14% after 15 months. The same strategy is not as statistically powerful in the context of the most recent tariffs. And this is true, although some products were exempted from the Liberation Day tariffs. But despite this, we do not see a systematically larger decline in Chinese exports to the US in those markets that were not exempted compared to those that were exempted. So because of this, we are unable to really quantify the magnitude of trade deflection econometrically, but still we do see a concomitant large drop in Chinese exports to the US. and a rise in the growth of exports towards the rest of the world. And for Europe, we are talking about a cumulative growth of imports from China that has reached 8.7% in 2025, which suggests some deflation might be at play.
Thank you very much for that introduction. Alicia, as Isabel has just concluded, that in the Trump 1 area, they found roughly one-third of the decline in Chinese export actually went to the US, was absorbed by the EU. Do you think that magnitude surprised you? And do you think it will hold for Trump 2 once we have more data? Because now we're still in the early stage.
Well, there's so many things happening under Trump, too, that I wonder whether we can even estimate what's the exports going towards Europe, which should have gone to the US. What I can tell you is that something very simple, actually, is that when you look at China's direction of trade in 2025, you're actually, for China, Europe lost market share in terms of exports. Not as much as the US. But certainly there was a reduction in our share of Chinese exports. The biggest increase was ASEAN, and you may argue that that's partially because of rerouting, but it increased across the board for all of the global south. What I'm trying to say here is that there's not only diversion of trade away from the US to Europe or elsewhere, but there's also this increasingly relevant market for China, which is the global south. Part of which, when you go country by country, you look at, I don't know, Venezuela, Iran, are really captive markets. So we're talking about countries which import 80% of what they import from China. So there's more happening in a way. I think China is developing this kind of captive market structure for countries, whether it's rogue states, say Myanmar, another example, or sanctioned countries. And then there's the specific issue of this report, which is really about moving away from the US elsewhere and partially to Europe.
Thanks for that. Let's come back to the report. Vincent, in your paper, it identifies precious metals, vegetable products, fats and oils, and base metals as the most affected sectors during Trump 1. But apparently for the Trump 2 story now, it seems to be low-value parcels flooding in after the US closed its minimis loophole. Do you think that's a representative picture of the broader deflection risk, or is this a special case?
Actually, yes and no. If you look at the export of low-value articles from China to the EU or the US, this is really a case in point of trade deflection. So you see this parallel increase of export to the US and the EU until the end of the de minimis exemption in May 2025. Following this end of de minimis exemption, you have a drop in the export to the US. It is divided by two, and an acceleration to the EU. The increase is plus 80%. So this is really a case in point for trade deflection. And this is not a minor issue because they represent this export. They represent 5% of Chinese export to the EU. So this is a significant part of the Chinese export to the EU. Those products, they are also very specific, actually. First, Chinese export of small parcels, they were growing really fast before Trump, in line with the increasing role of the platform like Shein or Temu in the retail industry. So this is something which is larger than the issue of trade policy. So this is really a specific sector in this respect. Second, they have been particularly hit by the protectionist policy of the second Trump administration because they went from zero tariff, zero duties, to the full tariffs cumulative from the first Trump administration and the second Trump administration. So this represent this can represent like $200 for some of these parcels. So this is quite large, and so the tariff increase is larger than for the average Chinese export to the US. So this is really specific. But that being said, those low-value products are also representative of the broader picture because they are consumer goods. This is a dimension of heterogeneity across products that we find in our data and that matter a lot. Because what we find is that the redirection of trade towards the EU is stronger for these consumer goods than for intermediate goods or capital goods, which are often associated with the kind of global value chain with long-term relationship between importers and exporters. And this is exactly the same. We also find this for goods that are considered as by low stickiness in trade relationships, which means that they are easier to reorganize these trade flows. And so those two findings point to the same mechanism, actually, that there are some trade flows that are less rigid, and so they can be redirected more easily. And these low-value parcels, they are really representative in this respect of these consumer goods that can be redirected from the US market to the EU market, I think.
Isabel, the paper proposes a quantitative surveillance mechanism to flag products at risk of redirection to the EU. So could you tell us how does it work and how does it differ from what the European Commission is already doing?
Yeah, so what Alicia just said, I think it's very true, is that the whole environment right now is a mess, and I don't think that we'll ever manage to do some very clean econometrics to kind of quantify the extent of trade deflection. But what we've learned from the Trump One experiment is that this trade deflection can be sizable. And so that means that because of this potentially big redirection of trade towards third countries, including Europe, there is some risk of those flows kind of disrupting some product markets. So what we propose in the paper is to not to wait until more data is available, but to already keep track of product markets that are, say, likely to be disrupted by Chinese deflection. And so again, what the Trump One episode taught us is that a good indicator of deflection is the combination of a large decline in the volume of US imports from China, linked together with an increase in European imports of the same products from China. And so in the paper, we propose a very simple statistical procedure to identify this type of product markets that can be applied to the most recent data on Chinese exports without having to rely to a more complicated econometric. So to a large extent, this surveillance mechanism that we propose resembles things that the European Commission is already tracking. So from that point of view, we are not that original, let's say. However, what we argue is that this surveillance mechanism should be dedicated to China. And this is needed because, one, the size of the demand shock that the country is facing is really important. And two, we know that the magnitude of their the size of their manufacturing production capacities is sufficiently big so that any redirection of trade can be quite disruptive for European markets.
And are there similar tools that the European Commission is already using?
So in general, the European Commission is following kind of similar statistics on the growth of European imports. But as far as we know, there is nothing that is really dedicated to keeping track of imports from China. And so what we argue is that in this particular instance, given that the US trade policy is clearly discriminatory towards, targeting more specifically China, there is a larger risk coming from China that should be taken care of more systematically. So the targeting of or the surveillance on imports from China is really what is different from what the European Commission is already doing.
Alicia, I see you're nodding a lot when Isabel was talking.
Yes. Well, first of all, congrats for the report. I should have started there, but anyway, it's better late than never. So big congratulations. It's a very good report. Very good chapter. And I do agree with the recommendation, but I want to add two aspects to it. Yes, we have now, and Bessent told us that it's only going to be temporary up to July, but we do have a much lower level of tariffs for China, which, working as the devil advocate, could mean do not even bother to introduce this mechanism because the problem won't be there. And working around that devil advocate, I want to say that not at all. We need it anyway. And if you ask me, I would even expand it. And let me explain. So even if the tariffs were to be reduced, which again, the US court system is working on it. We still have two major issues that are happening, that China could still need to export beyond the numbers that would have fit the idea that the US could still absorb what it used to absorb before the tariffs. Yeah. And this is very simply the case because China's industrial production is growing certainly above GDP growth, but certainly above domestic demand. So we shouldn't stop this because even if they were in these emergency tariffs, the problem keeps on building anyway. It is not only about our own imports to add to the mechanism we need. We also have an issue in third markets, yeah? So once upon a time, I think the second paper I wrote, the first was in 2017, Russia, Europe, China, looking at trade diversion. And then the second in 2018, Latin America, China, Europe, same thing, a lot of trade diversion. Even then, just imagine now with China's much bigger industrial capacity, having moved up the ladder, having become much more of a competitor, if you want, in terms of export structure to Europe. So, you know, it is quite obvious that there will be a lot of that. The European Commission does have a trade diversion monitor, and I checked it today, and most of the relevant trade diversion numbers they find are all China related. So this is why I'm advocating what Isabel said, that we need a specific, I'm not talking even about yet about trade instruments or defensive instruments. No, I'm talking about monitoring to start. We really need to monitor the wealth of China's impact on our trade structure, whether it's because of the US tariffs or simply because of China's accumulating industrial capacity, which was my first point, or because of this massive impact on third markets where we also compete. So for that reason, no matter what happens with US tariffs, I would totally advocate for a much closer monitoring of the impact of China's trade policies for us.
And if I can add just one thing, I think the EU monitoring mechanism doesn't really apply to trade deflation because they don't look at what's happening in the US market. As Alicia was saying, there are different issues there. There is the issue of the increasing industrial capacity of China and the increasing similar structure of their export, which is different from trade deflation. And we need to be able to differentiate the threat from trade deflation, which can be disruptive in the short term for specific sector, from the other threat from the competition from China, which are more medium to long term and which require different policies, more structural industrial policies and maybe less trade defense instruments.
In the Trump first term, so China responded to the tariffs, not just with retaliatory tariffs, but also it cut its MFN tariffs for third countries, which actually helped open some doors for European exporters. So now is there a risk that Europe's more defensive reflex against deflation can cause it to miss some opportunities on the Chinese market?
Yes, indeed. This is something that we look at in the chapter. The Chinese response to Trump 1 was twofold. First, they retaliated against the US, but at the same time, they opened their market to third countries by reducing their MFN tariffs duties. And this is something that benefited to the EU with increasing export for those products for which the tariff duties decreased on an MFN basis. So this is what happened during Trump 1, but the situation today is quite different because today China has been retaliating towards the US as for the first Trump administration, but they have not liberalized their domestic market towards third countries. And what they did is to implement export control on rare earths or permanent magnets, which had an impact on European producers too. US producer, but a European producer as well as a producer all around the world. So China is not exactly on the same type of response to the US protectionism in the sense that they are not opening up their market this time. So this is the first thing. And the second thing is that the economic environment of the Chinese economy is also really different. And this is something Alicia touched upon just before. So the Chinese economy today has a very weak domestic demand, so a weak import growth. and they rely on export growth to compensate for the weak domestic demand. So there are not that much opportunities from export to Chinese consumers because of this weak consumption. And this is really different from what happened in 2018, 2019, because here there are not that much opportunities and the policies implemented by the Chinese government are not towards liberalizing their market. So there are not so much missed opportunities in the Chinese market this time. I don't think this is the main issue today, as it was maybe back in 2019. But I think the broader issue is how the EU responds to trade deflation by China, maybe by using a trade defense instrument, will have consequences for the broader EU-China trade relationship. And this could have an influence for the access to the Chinese market, but also to Chinese competition on the EU market in more generally.
It's about In Vincent's previous response, when we talked about the mini-me's, he mentioned a lot of these are actually consumer goods. So trade deflation, sometimes it can lower prices for European consumers, especially for these smaller parcels, which particularly at a time of inflation and squeeze household budgets, it could have some benefits, especially for the consumers. So how should policymakers weigh that in, the consumer benefits against these adjustment costs for European producers?
I think it's a question that addresses a very complicated trade-off that we're always facing in trade between kind of long-run benefits of trade liberalization and the short-run adjustment that changes in the geography of trade might require. So here, the way I think about it is that the problem is not that China is exporting large volumes of cheap products, as they do in general. So this is not a problem per se, that China is exporting these cheap products. And actually, there is ample evidence that these low-priced products benefit European consumers through increased real consumption. But what we know as well is that adjusting to a new equilibrium in which certain Chinese products are permanently cheaper is probably needed. And this is what Vincent was referring to when talking about structural policies that can handle this new equilibrium. Here we are talking about something a bit different, which is potentially disrupted volumes of production that could flow to the European market and thus compete with European productions within a few months. And so again, the nature of the change in the geography of trade is very important. Here, actually, the WTO has long recognized that such large and sudden flows of goods can be difficult to absorb, especially in economic structures that are kind of rigid. And this is the reason why trade defense instruments exist in the first place. So basically, our paper pushes for using these trade defense instruments more systematically to adjust to Chinese trade deflection. I mean, we are not really considering in this paper, but it's true as well, is that in the coming months and years, there will be some adjustment that will be needed to cope with the new structure of comparative advantages. And this might also require some policies, but this is kind of a different problem, I think. And from that point of view, I fully agree with Vincent and also Alicia. There are multiple problems coming in, and it's very important to kind of monitor the different sources of the problem precisely because they don't call for the same policies.
Of course, it's always a very complicated issue when it comes to trade. Maybe just to add some more complexities, even inside the EU, different member states are exposed very differently depending on their industrial structure. Does this also risk fracturing EU unity on trade policy, with some capitals pushing harder for protection and others are quietly welcoming cheaper imports in some way?
I think it's an important question, but it's a permanent challenge that European countries have to live with because the trade instruments are competence of the European Union. But the individual member states have very different needs for trade protection and very different demands for it. And so this has always been a kind of a challenge between say, the north and the south of Europe, or between France and Germany, you always have this type of conflict of interest when it comes to trade matters. So I don't think that this time is very different. So arguably, the countries that are the most exposed to this threat, both the short-run deflection of trade and the more long-run a rise in the competitiveness of China in some core sectors of the comparative advantage of Europe, are going to be those countries that produce these manufacturing goods. So here, there will be big adjustment to be done. And so there is more need for trade defense instruments and structural adjustment. But this is a problem that also concerns the whole Europe. So although different countries are going to pay different costs for it, this is an important issue. And this is really where Europe should be there to protect all citizens, despite different exposure to this type of risk.
Alicia?
Yeah, I mean, because I agree fully, maybe I just want to expand on what both of you, this idea that we need to really understand why we're here. By here, I don't only mean to say that we have a big bilateral deficit with China, which is in itself wouldn't have to be a problem if we didn't know why we have it. But we happen to know that part of that is trade deflection, which is what you analyze. And another part of that might be simply because, you know, you could argue that it just makes sense to be more integrated. China has cheap products, and you know that will make us more competitive. But the reality is that within that second package, there is a lot happening that we need to disentangle. So part of that is China being more productive, so we should know in which sector is China more productive. And in others, it might simply be that China is able to reduce prices. And by that, I would even look at the real bilateral exchange rate, so both exchange rate, but especially prices. I estimated that to be around 2/3. So the exchange rate is much smaller of an impact. But anyway, why do we have this constant pressure from lower and lower in prices? Is it because China is simply more competitive everywhere, or is it not? I think disentangling all of this would help us take the right decisions for each of the separate problems. Yeah, the temporary trade deflection one. I don't know, maybe safeguards, or I don't know, you probably are much better of a trade economist than me, but you know, you can identify by separating these different items. If China is able to, or Chinese companies are able to reduce prices simply because they receive subsidies, well, we have instruments for that, etc. So for me, it is very important, the work you did, and beyond, because there is still a lot of question marks that, you know, we need to work on. Why is that kind of external price competitiveness? Is it all real competitiveness or not? So, you know, again, I think there's a lot to be done. I think it's great that you already started, but this is just a call for continuing your great efforts. Yeah.
Thank you very much for that, Alicia. Anything to add here, Vincent?
Yeah, maybe I would like to bring one more point to the conversation. The fact that, yes, we have a big trade and growing trade deficit with China, but something which is unexpected. But when you look at the overall EU trade surplus, it hasn't moved that much. So this is still something close to 2% of GDP, so a trade surplus. So this means that, at least for now, this issue of Chinese competition is something which is much more a question of specialization. And I completely agree that we need to understand for each sector, what is the issue at stake? Is it trade deflection? Is it something more structural? And if it is more structural, is it related to industrial policies? Is it related to some comparative advantage, etc.? But this is not something which is related to the overall EU industrial base. This is something really that question the specialization, the industrial specialization of the European Union. And I think there is this short-term issue, more shorter-term issue of trade deflection, but in the longer term, this is not just trade policy. This is industrial policy at large that should be implemented in specific sector that we want to develop for specific reason, I think.
Thank you very much for that. For my closing question, if you each have one more policy recommendation for the EU, what would it be like on the base of this paper?
I hear you, Vincent. We have a nice, we've gone back because we lost a lot of that trade surplus because of that energy shock. By the way, we may have it again. So, you know, it's not guaranteed that first, because of temporary reasons, which would be the oil shock again, but even for more structural reasons. So again, if we know that China is moving up the ladder in so many sectors where we compete, even if I see a surplus, I should start watching. I should start really thinking about what the future trade balance is going to be, not so much the current trade balance, because we are also moving. We have a nice base effect, don't we? Because we were, again, under shock, and we're not kind of coming out of the shock. But that doesn't mean it's sustainable unless we can confirm that we still remain competitive in sectors, as you said, industrial specialization, where China is not entering. I'm coming from this China background. I doubt it. I can't prove what I'm saying, but I doubt it, because China has this kind of big strategy of being competitive everywhere, even in services. On top of that, the way for China to do that is literally in the infant industry, in the textbook concept of closing the market or you know, making it hard for others to use China's market at large, which is really, really at large, those economies of scale, and then become very competitive. So it's very hard for the rest of the world because you miss a big chunk of the global economy in terms of, you know, being able to compete. So for all of these reasons, I would be tempted to say, watch for the structural part. And I agree that what you did on the cyclical or tariff-related one is very important, and we can take trade defense measures. But no trade defense measure will protect us from a structural shock from China. I.e., we need to think, okay, what can we do? And I think for that, it's all about becoming more competitive, becoming more productive. I mean, there's no protection we can buy towards the structural reality that I think is shaping up.
Vincent?
Yeah, I completely agree with what Alicia said. Yeah, clearly the structural issue is really important. If you want to take one thing, I think, from our paper is that the more short-term issue of trade deflation is also important for specific sector. And this is something that the EU Commission should take into account, because this is really important in terms of how the industry and the population respond to the China shock. And how we can manage a relationship with China will be influenced by how we handle this trade deflation. But I fully agree that the big issue there is much more the structural issue, and this is way beyond the pure trade protection. This involves policies that are way beyond this.
Thank you. Anything to add, Isabel?
I think what we've kept on saying is that these are very difficult policy questions. But one thing which is very nice with China is that this is really a country where there is a lot of statistical action. So it's a big country. Things are changing fast. It's like investing massively. So there is a lot in the data, and I think a lot more that we've not documented yet. So Alicia was saying we cannot prove yet. I mean, there are a number of things that will be extremely difficult to prove. But I also believe that there's a lot of things that we can still investigate and identify in the data. And so basically, I think more work is needed. And here, there is a lot that should be done, both in academia and in policy circles.
Yes, indeed. You've been listening to The Sound of Economics. I am Yuyun Zhan, and I'm with Brugos Alicia Garcia-Herrero, Isabel Marjan from Science Po, and Vincent Vicard of CP. For listeners, you can find Isabel and Vincent's chapter in the Paris Report, EU Under Pressure, Exploring Chinese Trade Deflection at cepr.org, and all our research on China at brugo.org. And sign up for Zhonghua Mundus, our monthly China podcast and newsletter, with link in the show notes. Until next time, bye-bye.